This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Are federal air marshals up to the job? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Air marshals are getting mixed reviews after yesterday's shooting death of a passenger who claimed that he had a bomb. They're being praised for appropriate action that sends a message to terrorists. They're also being called inadequately trained to deal with mentally ill passengers, especially when others might be in the line of fire. On To the Point, there were 33 air marshals before September 11th. Now there are thousands. We'll hear reports that they're overworked and underpaid. Are they prepared for split-second decisions that can mean life or death? On Reporter's Notebook later on, two views of Iraq's reconstruction. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. For the first time, federal air marshals have shot and killed a passenger who claimed that he had a bomb. Relatives say he was mentally ill. On To the Point, did Rigoberto Alpizar have to die? Are air marshals trained well enough to cope with the challenges posed by this era of terrorism? On Reporter's Notebook, President Bush said yesterday that Iraq's reconstruction and economic recovery are picking up speed. We'll hear two different views of how much progress is being made. First, this news update. A compromise over civil rights concerns means that controversial provisions of the Patriot Act will be extended for 4 years instead of the 10 asked by hardliners in Congress and the Bush administration. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez told reporters any so-called sunset clause is unnecessary.
There is now a track record. We've had the Patriot Act for 4 years. People have seen how the Department of Justice has been very responsible in exercising the authorities under the Patriot Act. And for that reason, we've suggested that a sunset would not be appropriate. Obviously, members of Congress have disagreed with respect to very limited number of provisions. And it's certainly something that we can support.
Again, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez with obviously reluctant support for sunsetting some provisions of the Patriot Act. Rick Schmidt covers the Justice Department for the Los Angeles Times. Rick, always good to have you.
How are you, Warren?
One senator, Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, is threatening a filibuster to prevent even the 4-year extension. What are the provisions that are most at issue?
Well, one that everybody in America knows something about, the so-called library provision, otherwise known as Section 215, which is a provision that allows investigators to obtain all manner of business records, and that is so sweeping in nature that it has attracted the attention of the ACLU and librarians and among others. So that's sort of the signature or the poster child of the debate surrounding the Patriot Act. So that's one of those that will be sunsetted under this agreement. The other prominent one is something called Section 206 that deals with the ability of the government to get so-called roving wiretaps, you know, as opposed to just getting a court order to tap a particular phone. It allows the government to get a court order from the secret court that handles intelligence issues, allows them the government to obtain an order to tap multiple devices, so they don't have to keep going back to court all the time. So it's an enhancement the law enforcement is that was really important, and they've tried to couch as kind of a sort of logistical procedural kind of change, but. You know, it's opened up a bit of a can of worms for civil libertarians as well.
Well, the civil libertarians, what are they saying, other than Russ Feingold, who doesn't like it at all, about the fact that these are being extended at all, even if it's 4 years rather than 10?
Yeah, it's interesting. This whole notion of sunsets has really become a compromise vehicle in this whole debate. You know, I think it's significant that they are. You know, that they are being sunsetted. It continues to put the Justice Department on kind of a short leash here, you know. And as you noted in the earlier report, quoting Gonzalez, is something that the administration didn't think was necessary, and then they argued against, you know. But Congress doesn't really, you know, isn't willing to adopt, even a Republican majority isn't willing to sort of countenance a kind of trust me approach regarding some of these tools. And so, and moreover, given the earlier sunsets of these provisions, it is, you know, brought forth a profusion of evidence from the Justice Department and elsewhere, and then they've had to go up to Congress and sort of explain how these tools are used. And so I think Congress wants to maintain that kind of comfort level at least for a few more years.
Rick Schmidt with the Los Angeles Times. You write today about what you call the paradox of the Patriot Act in the case of Sami Al-Aryan. He is the Kuwaiti-born Palestinian who was a computer engineering professor at the University of South Florida, acquitted yesterday of almost all the charges against him, charges that got new life because of the Patriot Act. What was the process there?
Well, it's interesting. This is a case that has its roots more than a decade ago. It's one with a lot of gray hair, and it's been investigated for a very long while. And for whatever reason, the government never brought charges against Al-Aryan, during the 90s. Subsequent to the Patriot Act, his passage in 01 and the attacks of September 11 and New Republican administration and John Ashcroft and the Justice Department, you know, those events sort of combined to prompt the government to decide that, yeah, we're gonna file charges. And the Justice Department and Ashcroft made the case that with the Patriot Act, lowering the so-called wall that had long, as the theory goes, had long prevented intelligence agents from sharing what they knew about targets with criminal prosecutors, that this sharing of information allowed the government to build a criminal case.
So they were able to gather evidence that they couldn't otherwise have gathered, put it all together, present it to a jury, but the jury turned it down, said they didn't believe he was a fundraiser for Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Did the Attorney General, we just have a couple of seconds left, say whether he would refile that case?
You know, I think there's a lot of debate about that right now. I think one option available to the government is they may just seek Al-Aryan's deportation rather than retry the case. But I would say that there are a couple of other cases out there that have their roots, okay, you know, more than a decade ago. And I think the government may be a little concerned about the impact that this verdict may have on those trials as they move forward as well.
All right. Just to clarify, he was acquitted of some charges, but there were hung jury on others, and those would be the ones on which he could be retried. Rick Schmidt with the LA Times. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Yeah, you bet. Sure.
Back in a moment. Federal Air Marshals, are they up to the job? We'll talk about them in a moment on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, and Alni, back with To the Point. Not all the details are clear as yet, less than 24 hours since the incident, but apparently this is what happened yesterday at Miami International Airport in the afternoon. American Airlines Flight 924 was still at the gate. Other passengers now have told reporters that Rigoberto Alpizar ran down the aisle of the airplane, pursued by his wife, who was shouting, "He's sick, he's sick." He was confronted by two air marshals. He then indicated he had a bomb. Instead of dropping to the ground as ordered, Alpizar reached into his bag. The marshals shot and killed him. No explosives were found. Tom Quinn heads the Air Marshal Service.
We have to take every threat very seriously, and if an individual says they have a bomb in their bag, we have to believe that there's a potential possibility there is. So we have to act in a law enforcement mode to try to neutralize the situation.
Tom Quinn, again, of the Air Marshals Service, speaking on CNN earlier today. Andrew Thomas is an aviation security analyst, author of Aviation Insecurity, The New Challenge of Air Travel, and Air Rage, Crisis in the Skies. He also teaches international business at the University of Akron in Ohio. Andrew Thomas, welcome to our program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Did these marshals have any choice?
No, and in looking at this, I think it would be irresponsible for somebody to second guess what they did. They probably made the right move given the parameters in which they're operating, and they had no idea the individual didn't have a bomb. And to second guess that, I think, would again be really disingenuous.
So, what then does it tell us about the training of air marshals? If you, as you indicated, they didn't have any idea of what was going on, didn't have any choice.
Yeah, this speaks to a greater issue, and it's fortuitous in many ways, and with all respect to the passing of the individual who was killed yesterday. We're coming up on a very important date here, December 22nd, with regards to aviation security in this country, and that's when the TSA is going to begin to reduce the amount of prohibitive items that people can get through checkpoints. In other words, we're going back to the pre-9/11 days of scissors, of longer bladed knives, of things that you weren't allowed to take on planes since 9/11. And this is going to probably create, and I think most thinking people would agree, a situation where air marshals, flight attendants, and passengers in the cabins of air crews, in the cabins of aircraft, are now going to have to deal with the very real possibility of disruptive passengers, as this individual was yesterday, brandishing weapons, maybe using them against themselves or others. And then for the case of the air marshals, what do they do about it? I heard Tom Quinn's comment, the director of the Air Marshal Program, and he mentioned that they acted in a law enforcement manner. That's concerning to me because air marshals are not law enforcement folks. They're security specialists. And security is about being proactive, whereas law enforcement waits for things to happen. And I'm a little concerned about the gray area that's evolving here in the air cabin environment.
Are the air marshals well enough trained to be proactive in the way that you're describing?
Well, they're proactive in a way that's anti-terrorist. That's been their overall mission from the beginning, going all the way back to the early 1970s. They still receive training about protecting the cockpit door, first and foremost, and then secondly dealing with explosives on board. The issue then we need to ask ourselves is if they're dealing with people who are drunk, who might be brandishing some kind of a weapon, people who are being verbally offensive, people who are pushing or shoving, is this a moment when air marshals need to act, or should they just allow passengers and flight attendants to deal with that issue? These parameters really haven't been defined yet. Part of it's because flight attendants are still woefully undertrained with regards to security and risk assessment in the cabin. Passengers are becoming more complacent 4 years after 9/11 now, so it's really kind of a new area for us and something that our federal officials, I certainly hope, are paying attention to, although I'm a little concerned given the past history of these organizations.
Well, given what you've just said, especially about security and risk assessment training, I don't want to make you second-guess what happened yesterday. I understand your reluctance to do that. I think everybody is reluctant to do that. But what about the risk to other passengers under those circumstances? Certainly they appear in the aftermath to have been terrified.
Sure.
By what happened. Did that all have to take place? Did this man have to die, and did he have to die in the way that he did?
Well, the fact that it took place on the jetway raises a little bit of a concern in terms of was the plane and the passengers on the plane, even more than passengers, certainly the plane, were they higher at risk because this individual was doing what he was doing, yelling. The fact that he reached for a bag, said he had a bomb, again, I believe that the air marshals acted properly within the parameters. My greater concern is that incidents like this aren't nearly as prevalent as people who are drunk, people who are just being abusive, people who are under the influence of narcotics or have not taken their narcotics, who don't take it to the level where they say they have a bomb. That was pretty clear, it seems to me, that they needed to use force to take the man down. But what happens if somebody starts wielding a knife and there's a couple air marshals on board? Do we shoot him? He can't kill people. He maybe hurt some people, maybe kill himself or somebody else, but he's not going to blow up a plane with 300 people on it. So there needs to be some kind of a delineation here. And my concern is that the training that flight attendants and that air marshals are receiving currently doesn't jive with that.
Andrew Thomas, aviation security analyst and author, as we mentioned earlier. Among those people most concerned about all of this, of course, are the people in the pilot's compartment. Captain Dave Mackett is president of the Airline Pilots Security Alliance. He's also a pilot himself. And, Captain, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your take, if you will, first on what happened yesterday, second on some of the issues that Andrew Thomas has raised about the future.
Well, I think that knowing what we know now, unless there's a piece of information that is completely contradictory to what we've heard so far, the shooting is going to be ruled justifiable, almost certainly. I think if this had been an actual event and the man had a bomb, I think these two air marshals might have been responsible for saving the lives of hundreds of people. What I guess I hope is not lost in the shuffle, though, is that while this event proves how critical it is to have the tools on board to immediately stop a threat, the vast majority of flights remain completely defenseless. The LA Times reported this morning that only 3% of our flights are covered by air marshals. So if 97% of our flights don't have that capability or don't have that protection and financially we can't afford it, This flight was very, very lucky to have these two individuals on board.
Back to the question you raised earlier, that perhaps if he'd had a bomb, these gentlemen would have saved a lot of lives. Isn't it possible that by shooting him, they might have caused the bomb to go off?
I think that's very, very unlikely. The air marshals actually are law enforcement officers, and they're very highly trained. I've seen some of their training. They're very highly skilled marksmen. There actually are very well-defined parameters within their service for what they react to and how they react. We have had incidents on board flights that where we did happen to have air marshals aboard, and where you have a disturbing passenger or a drunk or a case where someone gets upset, and they have very clear protocols for when they take action and when they don't. One of the things we actually, or they and us, worry about is a sleeper agent, an Al-Qaeda operative who gets up and creates a disturbance in order to draw out the air marshals so that the rest of the terrorist team can identify them. And they're very well aware of that. They basically don't take action until there is a direct life-threatening event taking place on the airplane and that they are absolutely needed to handle.
Are you worried about the new rules allowing scissors, knives, the kinds of things that Andrew Thomas was talking about?
I'm worried that it's kind of like we have a Swiss cheese security system, and I'm asking, why are we making the holes bigger? But on the other hand, the TSA is basically admitting that they don't have the resources to screen out both bladed weapons and bombs, so they're going to concentrate on bombs. My question would be, why then are they not, first of all, why did they tell the public? Why didn't they make this change quietly and just continue doing what they do? But the bigger question is, why are we not utilizing some of the, better allocating some of the alternative resources to better defend these airplanes in light of the fact that we're going to let more dangerous objects on board? Why are we not dramatically expanding the Federal Flight Deck Officer Program, which has the ability to protect 97% of our flights for $29 million a year?
What's that? What does that mean?
The program to arm our pilots.
Okay.
For example, the Federal Air Marshal Program's budget is almost $700 million a year, and if the LA Times is correct and it protects only 3% of our flights, why are we not instead using pilots cross-trained as federal law enforcement officers to protect almost all of our flights at a cost of only $29 million a year? Wouldn't you rather have a $29 million system that protects everybody than a $700 million system that protects almost no one and free the air marshals to work the flights where we have intelligence or we have a person on a watch list or some of the really higher threat flights?
Captain Dave Mackett, again, president of the Airline Pilot Security Alliance. The watch list, of course, raised by the former 9/11 commission earlier this week. We don't have time to talk about that specifically on this program. Just wanted to make that point. But back to Andrew Thomas, again, our aviation security analyst. What do you think about arming the pilots? Is that a good idea? Can they be adequately trained to be both pilots and security officers?
Well, initially when the program was rolled out, I thought it to be a questionable security measure. But as time has evolved, I've become more in favor of it. And I would like to see a ramping down of the air marshal program and, as the captain said, the dedication of the tremendous resources that are entailed in keeping that programming running, and instead push it over to the pilots to protect the cockpit as the last line of defense. I think what the captain said, too, was very true with regards to the fact that we're making a lot of holes bigger with regards to security. There's no direct relationship between allowing more prohibitive items or seemingly prohibitive items now permitted on the aircraft, like these knives and scissors, and that doesn't mean that the screeners at the checkpoints are going to be capable to now turn their attention and find, in fact, explosive devices or components of explosive devices. That goes back to training as well, and the record is very clear from GAO reports, from DHS reports, that by increasing the risk in the risk in the cabin, we're not in fact reducing the security of explosives because they still can't find that kind of stuff in many cases.
Andrew Thomas, again, our aviation security analyst. Earlier, Captain Mackett said he thought that the marshals were very skilled as marksmen and very well trained. There's a story today in the USA Today newspaper by senior editor Blake Morrison, the headline of which is Air Marshal Program in Disarray, according to Air Marshals. Blake Morrison, welcome to our program.
Hi. I just want to clarify, that wasn't in today's newspaper.
I beg your pardon.
That's okay, but it's a story I've written about when the Air Marshal Service started.
Okay.
And, it basically, the story was talking a lot about the need to hire a whole bunch of air marshals to take over these jobs after September 11th and how they lowered the standards that had once been in place in the air marshal program prior to the terrorist attacks in order to get as many people aboard planes as they could.
What about the training in marksmanship?
Well, what they did at the onset of the program, when they basically restructured the program to hire a whole bunch of people, is they changed the caliber of course that was needed to be able to be an air marshal. It used to be something called a tactical pistol course, and it became something called a practical pistol course. The issue was simply this: you didn't need to be as good a marksman to pass the new course as you needed to be in the previous incarnation of the air marshal program. And a number of people who were air marshals before September 11th said, look, that was the critical component of our marksmanship course. That was what made it possible for you to fire safely on an airplane as opposed to firing safely, for instance, outside. And so they were very concerned that you were putting a number of people aboard these flights who might not be as good a marksman as they need to be.
Had applicants been failing the test?
There had been applicants who had been failing the test, and as the program grew, more and more were, and that was part of the reason that I was told they changed the marksmanship requirements, because if everybody was failing the test, they certainly couldn't ramp up the program as effectively. If I could go back for 1 minute too, Warren, I think one thing to keep in mind when Andrew, who I respect a great deal, says, of course, these guys were right to do what they did, I think this is like any police shooting of anybody. We don't really know exactly what happened. We know what various people have said, but I think at this point there's going to be an investigation, obviously, into whether they behaved properly. And given what we know now, which is all coming from the government, it sounds like, and some witnesses there, it certainly has the appearances that they didn't have many choices. But I think it's also important, as we take a look at this program and we take a look at the responsibilities that these people have, which is basically carry a gun, that we make sure that we don't pass judgment one way or the other as to whether this was the appropriate step that was taken.
I think the Air Marshal Service would agree with everything that you said, although we did hear the head, Tom Quinn, earlier say he didn't think they had any choice. But as you point out, there will be investigations conducted, and both of the individuals involved in this have been suspended until the investigations take place. So in that respect, it's like any shooting by a law enforcement organization. And Blake Morrison of USA Today, you're right to make that point, and thank you for doing it. Also in your story about that you summarized a moment ago with regard to the pistol shooting training requirements, you've mentioned, and it's been mentioned as well since your story and mentioned today, that the air marshals are very concerned about the dress code and the grooming that is required. It says that they claim that they are easily identifiable. Did you find that was a big concern of theirs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the issue is this. When you put an air marshal aboard any flight, you also put a gun aboard that flight. And since air marshals travel in at least pairs of two or more, you introduce two guns to that plane. And, you know, I think some of the real issues that are being raised now are whenever you put a gun aboard a plane, you put the possibility aboard a plane that someone's going to fire that gun. It may be the air marshal who's trying to respond to a hijacking situation, or it could be a terrorist who tries to basically take charge of the plane and manages to get control of the air marshal. And then suddenly a terrorist who couldn't get a gun maybe past a screener has a gun aboard a plane. And part of the issue that air marshals had, their concerns were, if they know who we are, if you can spot who the air marshal is either because you get on a plane and there are two people are sitting or because of how we're dressed or how we're groomed, if they know who we are, they know where the guns are.
Okay, and as earlier mentioned, a sophisticated organization could try to smoke them out and identify them and then have other people attack and perhaps take their weapons away. We're going to continue this conversation after a brief break. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, President Bush says progress is being made in Iraq's reconstruction. We'll hear two different views about that. Back in a moment with To the Point on PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the tragic incident yesterday where two air marshals shot a man who said that he had a gun, refused to fall to his knees when they asked him to, reached instead for his bag, said he had a bomb rather than a gun. and that he was shot and killed. We're going to move on in a moment to the question of his mental capacity, one of the issues raised by this incident. But first, we just heard from Blake Morrison, senior editor for USA Today, about a story he wrote a couple of years ago as the Marshal Service was being drastically increased in the aftermath of September 11th, about the changing in standards for marksmanship, and also we were raising the question about the dress code, the grooming requirements now imposed by the Marshal Service, which some marshals have said they are not allowed to speak publicly, incidentally, so it's very difficult to get them to speak. But some have let it be known that they think that allows them to be singled out. I want to go back to Captain Dave Mackett of the Airline Pilots Security Alliance. On those two points, do you think that there ought to be better training for the marshals? Are you concerned? Have they managed to take care of that since Blake Morrison wrote his story?
Well, I think there's no question that the Federal Air Marshal Service has suffered from growing pains, and I think they continue to suffer from, let's say, inadequate management. I know they've been at loggerheads with their head, Tom Quinn, over the dress code issue. The fact that Mr. Quinn has no background in aviation or as an air marshal, he's an ex-Secret Service guy. So they do have challenges there. Our organization, for example, last year proffered legislation, bipartisan legislation that was designed to expand the Federal Flight Deck Officer Program. Mr. Quinn wrote an internal memo that suggested that the Federal Flight Deck Officer or Armed Pilot Program should not be expanded because or standardized, as all the bill asked for, because the pilots, the FFDOs, were not being trained to, I think his words were, execute search warrants, interview suspects, or question witnesses. So when you see that kind of an attitude, it's just very frustrating for the airline pilot community, since the FFDOs don't do any of those things, to see that kind of management style. And I think that's what the Federal Air Marshals have been facing also.
All right. It should mention that we asked the Air Marshals Service to appear on our program, either have Tom Quinn or one of his deputies be on our show, and they declined our invitation. I do want to turn now to the issue of the gentleman himself, Rigoberto Alpizar, who died yesterday. Blake Morrison, back to you, senior editor for USA Today. What did you learn about the training of air marshals for a situation like this, when you have a mentally ill person who makes a claim and you don't have any way to figure it out? What are marshals trained to do?
Well, the marshals that I talk to say that they're basically trained to deal with a threat. They're not diagnosing conditions of people. They're not taking a look and saying, is he mentally ill or is he sane? I mean, I don't think anybody is very capable of doing that for a complete stranger. Their job is just like any police officer or law enforcement officer, which is there an immediate threat and how do I deal with that threat? And so they're not sitting there trying to figure out, could he be a terrorist or could he just be somebody who may not be on his medication? It really is an irrelevant situation at that point if they think he's a threat. And clearly the position that the Marshal Service is taking, and it's no one's surprise, is that this person presented himself to them as a threat. And so it became immaterial whether it was somebody with a... I mean, there's nothing that says that a terrorist couldn't have a mental condition, and there's nothing that says someone who has a mental condition couldn't be a terrorist. So it becomes inconsequential when you start talking about assessing threat levels.
Threat is a threat regardless of who it comes from under what circumstances.
Absolutely.
Should just point out that passengers have been telling reporters that Alpizar's wife did try to stop him from running down the aisle, did call out, he's sick, even used the term bipolar at one point. Again, this is all hearsay at this point, and no investigation has been conducted. Mary Zygmunt-Danowitz is founding executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center, which is a national nonprofit that is dedicated to mental illness, and we're glad to have you on our program.
Thank you.
What do you say to what we just heard? Would it be possible to train air marshals or anybody else to make the kinds of distinctions that would have been necessary, for example, in this case, to ask the second question, which would be, well, is this guy really, does he really have a bomb, or is he for some reason simply making a threat?
Well, I think it's nearly impossible, as Mr. Morrison said, to try to diagnose someone instantaneously on
sure.
the spot like that and make that kind of a determination. And I certainly don't envy these law enforcement officers who are put in this position of having to make those determinations. And unfortunately, the bigger issue is, why is it that they are facing those kinds of questions so often around the country and now you know, this is not the first time we've had this kind of an episode on a plane. It's unfortunately the first one that ended in death. But the question is, why is law enforcement the front line in this country for dealing with people who are in psychiatric crisis?
So what are you suggesting? Who should be the front line if it's not law enforcement? What are we failing to do?
Well, it's mental health professionals, really, that should be diagnosing and treating people who have these illnesses before they become a threat. And the problem is that we don't take these illnesses seriously enough in this country. I can cite to you case after case of incidents where because we don't take the illnesses seriously enough, because we let people deteriorate to the point where they are a danger, not only is the person themselves in jeopardy, but law enforcement and the public are put in jeopardy. Never mind the questions about quality of life that are at issue for these individuals.
Well, in this case, it does appear that he had been diagnosed, if we are to believe the hearsay reports from the passengers, because his wife said he's bipolar and he doesn't have his medicine, a very specific thing, which you mentioned a moment ago. How could this situation have been avoided?
I don't know about this situation. We don't have enough facts. But I know that in many of these cases, the problem is that the individual is not taking their medication. And in a majority of those cases, it's because the person doesn't even realize they're ill. And that's something that's so significant that we must recognize about these illnesses. One of the effects is that for some individuals, they don't even realize that they're ill. They become delusional, they have hallucinations, hear voices, and they don't know that it's not real. They cannot distinguish between reality and what's happening because of their brain disease. In those cases, if an individual is refusing treatment, we, in many cases in this country, many states, the law either requires or we interpret it to require that we have to wait till the person becomes dangerous. And in many cases like this one, that is too late. Again, we don't know in this case if that's true, that he was not taking his medication deliberately because he didn't think he needed it. But I can cite to you case after case where that is the case, and it's a travesty.
This situation comes about, as we've talked about on this program before, in part because of the feeling back in the 60s and 70s that people were being warehoused in mental institutions, incarcerated against their will, and it was thought that there was a civil rights issue there. Mental hospitals were closed down. Halfway houses to take care of such patients were never established, and so we have the situation that you're describing. Is there any easy fix to this?
Well, there's never an easy fix, and in fact, the fix is not an easy one for anyone to accept, but it is that we can, in fact, require people to participate in treatment in the community. You're absolutely right. I mean, the hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, are all but extinct now. There are very few inpatient psychiatric hospitals. But as well, we know that most people can be treated very successfully in the community if they participate in treatment and if they take their medication. Now, the trend around the country is to require that people participate in treatment if they are, you know, what I'm describing, someone who is psychotic, who does not realize that they're ill, who is not well enough to accept treatment, and if they don't have treatment, have a history of, you know, very serious and bad outcomes like jail or violence.
All right.
The trend is to require that they take medication.
Mary Zdanowicz, founding executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center. I'm glad that you appeared on our program to make those points. Just quickly, back to Blake Morrison with USA Today. You indicated that as far as law enforcement is concerned, they got to deal with the threat regardless of where it comes from. Are they, though, as a result of the circumstances that we just heard described, trying to become at least more sensitive to these issues so that there might at least in some cases be a possibility of not shooting too soon?
I just don't know how you can. And, you know, as I listened to the description, you know, I was struck by, we did put something in today's paper about sort of the history of passengers with mental illness or problems on planes. And one I hearken back to that I wrote about right after September 11th, a man who was suffering from encephalitis, didn't know he was that sick, pulled out a pocket knife, tried to break into the cockpit in Alaska Airlines flight. If you have air marshals aboard that flight, I guarantee that that person is going to be dead. And the real issue that we're running into, especially as you see TSA moving back to allowing people to take on scissors and so on, is what happens if those people then suddenly, either deranged or terrorists, start using those as weapons? What choice do those federal air marshals have? And I think that's the real issue: is, you know, are we comfortable with that scenario, with putting those guns aboard planes?
Captain Mackett with the Airline Pilot Security Alliance, your point with regard to the change of the rules of late to allow more sharp, small instruments to go on board seems to me borne out by what we've been hearing.
It's borne out. We have in terms of the shoot-no-shoot decision, what we are facing today, and the reason the TSA is wants to divert their resources to bomb detection, is there's sort of a confluence of technology that's taking place. On the one hand, you have the ability now to bring components of bombs on board. Then they don't even look like bombs when they go through screening, and we can't stop them. And then the bomb can be put together on board the airplane along with a remote detonator that is not even connected by a wire. So, and the other side of the confluence is you have a suicidal terrorist who's not afraid to instantly detonate that bomb. And he can do so as quickly as reaching for the zipper on his jacket if that's where it's hidden. So you have to act very quickly in terms of addressing these threats. My one thought when we were discussing the behavior of the person is that I saw a report from a passenger who said this individual was acting strangely at customs or in the terminal lounge. And one thing we need to dramatically expand is behavioral profiling and expand it. We don't have it. So we need to implement behavioral profiling training for TSA screeners, for flight attendants, so that they can recognize abnormal behavior and can hopefully put a stop to it or address the situation before it gets as critical as it got yesterday.
All right. Interesting point. Presumably there would be some objections to that kind of approach having to do with civil rights and the possibility of making mistakes. We don't have time to argue it at this point, but thanks for making the observation. And we'll pick it up again on a later program. Obviously, this is one situation or one topic that will not be going away, tragic and terrifying, though it may be. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Captain Dave Mackett, president of the Airline Pilot Security Alliance, Blake Morrison, senior editor for USA Today, Marek Zygmanowicz, a founding director of the Treatment Advocacy Center, and our earlier guest, Andrew Thomas, again, professor of international business at University of Akron, Ohio, and aviation security analyst. In his latest speech to bolster support for the war in Iraq, President Bush said yesterday that military action is only the first step. He said what he called the battle after the battle includes reconstruction and economic recovery, and he gave examples of progress that's being made. In a moment, we'll get two different assessments of all that on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The president conceded in yesterday's speech that Iraq reconstruction has not always gone as well as we'd hoped, but he insisted the effort is picking up speed. Ginger Cruz is Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. That's an office of the American government. And Ginger Cruz, a deputy inspector, we're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
You announced a couple of weeks ago the first arrest of an American official charged with taking $546,000 in illegal payments for steering more than $13 million in contracts to another American businessman. You said at the time, there's more to come, 50 other potential criminal cases. How are they going?
Well, they are going well. Actually, to date, we have had 3 arrests in connection with that case. And in addition to that case, there are other cases that our office is continuing to investigate. And if we do find wrongdoing, we will take those that are responsible and we will bring them to justice.
If you have 50 pending cases, it sounds like there's a lot of wrongdoing, at least potentially.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a lot. We have to be very careful how we characterize that. When you're talking about a $20 billion reconstruction program in what is essentially a very chaotic situation, there are cases in which certain people were found to have been doing something that violated the law, and we are finding those individuals. But overall, I think it's very important to also emphasize that there's a lot of work being done, and it's very difficult to oversimplify or to characterize an entire very complex program by the fact that we've had 3 arrests.
Back in the days of the Coalition Provisional Authority before the Iraqi election, there were reports that it was lax in its oversight of the spending of not only American money, but Iraqi money as well. Have you found that to be the case?
Our audits have found that to be the case. I think one of our most foundational audits was the one that found that because of the chaotic nature of the Iraqi interim government at the time, we felt that there should have been more safeguards in the turnover of money, and we could not assure that the money that had been turned over to the Iraqi government, in the case of that audit, $8 billion, was adequately stewarded when it was handed over. And so we felt that stronger controls should have been put in place, and that's essentially what we found.
I don't know if this fits within your jurisdiction or not, but one of the arguments that's been made with regard to the reconstruction is that there's been insufficient success in bringing back the oil industry, three-fourths of the Iraqi economy still operating at this time below pre-war output and unable to help contribute to the rest of the reconstruction effort. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the reconstruction priorities were set very early on when the United States put the bill together to give $18.4 billion, which is the bulk of the reconstruction money. There was a specific amount of money that was set aside for development of the oil sector. And unfortunately, a portion of that money, as with all of the sectors, has ended up being diverted to security because, as we found out, you can't really accomplish reconstruction without having a secure and foundation for the reconstruction effort. And I think that that was something that was not perhaps anticipated well enough in the beginning. And as a result, we're paying the price now by not being able to do as much of the reconstruction effort in the oil sector and in all the sectors because we've had to re-divert that money in order to train and put more emphasis on the security component of the Iraqi government.
Has there been an effort to try to increase the total amount of money available so that that reconstruction money doesn't have to be diverted to security?
I believe the State Department is looking very closely at the donor funds because as we've looked at the overall scheme of reconstruction, the United States has given over $20 billion to the effort. And while donor countries had pledged up to $13 billion, a lot of that money has not really turned into actual donations yet. So I think there is a need to encourage other members of the coalition and other members of the global community to, in the interest of international security, to also donate towards that. And for us to really help the Iraqi government, as they're facing their elections, to firm up their capability to strengthen the oil sector and turn their own revenue to better use.
And when you make the point about security and its changing of the priorities in regard to spending, it's my understanding that some of the projects that were originally envisioned have had to be either abandoned or reduced, and the focus then has been on smaller projects, again, for security reasons. Is that right?
That is true. Again, it's a very complex process. Initially, there were 5,000 projects that were identified, and the $18 billion was expected to do about 3,000 of those projects. Today, we see about 2,000 projects that are done, and several of those have been de-scoped, and the anticipation of having something completed is not quite coming to fruition because some of that money has had to be spent on security or for other purposes. There have been a total of 5 reprogramming activities that have occurred, and money has been shifted from one section to another section. And at the end of the day, there hasn't been any addition to that pot of money. And while there still is a little bit left to be obligated, it's important that the limitations of the funding to date have to be taken into consideration.
Ginger Cruz, again, Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, speaking to us from Washington. Issam al-Khafaji is a former reconstruction advisor to the Coalition Provision Authority. Again, that was the organization running the country until there was the interim government was replaced after the election. He's also a former director of Iraq Revenue Watch. He is an Iraqi scholar and professor, and he joins us from Jordan. Mr. al-Khafaji, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
What is your opinion of the progress that's being made now in the reconstruction of Iraq?
Well, first, let me applaud the efforts, although they are late, the late efforts that to trickle down where the corruption and waste of money has gone and the beginning of some judiciary processes against those who are implicated. I really have to be to look at the other side, not the rosy side of the picture. I just came back from Iraq, and I am very sad to report that actually the basic services, which are electricity, the fuel, etc., are still, there's no improvement in these basic services that Iraqis were waiting for. The frightening thing is that many people, although they do hate the regime of Saddam Hussein, are now comparing it with what happened after 1991, after the first Gulf War, when and they say, why is it that Saddam Hussein could bring electricity back in within 1 year, and the superpower, the United States, is not able to bring back power after almost 3 years. The oil facilities have seen some improvement, but corruption is rampant, including in sectors where, although we have formally regained sovereignty, but there are sectors that are under tight control of the coalition forces. For example, the security, the building of the security and the military. And there is a huge corruption that is talked about and reported, actually, in the Iraqi press and among Iraqis.
How would you describe that corruption? Is it on the part of Iraqis? Is it on the part of the occupying American forces, or both?
Well, it seems to me, but I want to underline the word seems to me, because that could bring legal problems in the definition, that both are implicated. For example, there is a case of a billion dollar loss of money in last year, and under the previous government of Dr. Iyad Alawi, when the Minister of Defense, with the collaboration of the with the approval of the United States, has agreed upon the helicopters that were supposed to be supplied from Poland, one of the partners in the coalition forces, and it was discovered after committing the $1 billion that these helicopters were out of date. They are 28 years old, and they have not been delivered to the Iraqi army up till now. Now, this is very much associated with what President Bush and everybody wants to, that unless we think about seriously and hastily build an Iraqi security force and Iraqi armed forces, there can't be any talk about an exit strategy or withdrawal of the U.S. Troops. On the service sector, there isn't any improvement, even in the secure governors or provinces in Iraq. In Najaf, for example, which President Bush has used the other day as an example, actually, people were demonstrating in the streets because there's nothing that's improving. The unemployment is running very, very high, and that could be a fueling factor for the insurgency when some terrorist groups or insurgent groups, whatever you want to call them, offer somebody $2,000 to throw a grenade or use a car, an explosive car. So these issues, security, improvement in the services, up till now we have not reached a point where the United States or the Iraqi government can tell the people, look, those provinces that are relatively secure have proved to benefit from that security. Unfortunately, we are not doing that yet.
Issam al-Khafaji, again, former advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority and a former director of Iraq Revenue Watch. Let me go back to Ginger Cruz, your deputy inspector general for the Iraq Reconstruction. I don't know how many of the issues raised by Mr. al-Khafaji come under your purview, but what about the billion-dollar loss that he attributes to the to corruption with regard to the helicopters from Poland?
That investigation is being led by the Iraqi side of the government. We meet regularly with the head of the Commission on Public Integrity, which is the corollary to the it's sort of the FBI of Iraq, and we exchange information, and we have an agreement with them where if there are cases that they are pursuing, and that $1 billion is a case that they and the Board of Supreme Audit are continuing to pursue. If there are any indications that there was any U.S. involvement, we have agreements with them that they will provide us that information, and we will investigate that information. I think that it's important to note that, you know, there is no tolerance on the American side for any corruption, and I believe that those few people that we have found to be engaging in corruption, we have found three to date that have been arrested that are charged. And as we continue to find those people, we will bring them to justice. But we're also trying to provide an example to the Iraqis that is very important, because the Iraqi government must be able to strengthen its own anti-corruption efforts in order for their government to succeed. And we fully support their efforts. We have been not only exchanging information, but as we can, providing them access to training and other things that we can help them with, because we understand that in order for their government to really fight corruption, which could be even more dangerous than the insurgency itself in the long run, that we want to do everything that we can on the U.S. side to encourage that.
Mr. Al-Khafaji, let me go back to you. There are roughly three groups, one of which we haven't talked about yet. First, we've talked about the Iraqi government. We've talked about the American government. But there are a lot of private contractors in Iraq. To what extent are they involved, do you believe, Mr. Al-Khafaji, in corruption?
I think there is a wide margin of corruption here, and there are many, many anecdotal reports and stories about that. You know, corruption is a multifaceted process. First, with the use of so much cash, with the inflation, inflating the costs, I'm afraid that much of the taxpayer, the American taxpayers' money, as well as Iraqi money, is being wasted on intermediaries, brokers, etc. A few months ago, we made a calculation whereby it came out that actually 1/6 of the amount that is committed or obligated to an average contract goes into the implementation process. Now, not all that is corruption or embezzlement of money. The problem is that there is a tendency...
I'm going to interrupt you, and I apologize for that, but we're almost out of time, and I'd like to get Deputy Inspector Cruz to respond on this question. Do you have authority over the private contractors, and do you have responsibility for efficiency when, as he says, intermediaries, brokers are sucking up a lot of the money?
Absolutely. We have one audit that is specifically targeting that issue. We are looking at administrative task orders. In other words, if it's not specifically fraud or corruption, if it's being wasted, we are looking at that, and we will issue that report.
Ginger Cruz and Issam Al-Khafaji, thank you both very much for being with us. We'll come back to this issue as time goes on. Today's program produced by Ileana Justice with Karen Radziner and Katie Cooper. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.